Accession number 17629, Mr. David Ridley, Reel 2.
Mr. Ridley, Reel 2. Growing up in Pelton area, we've talked about schooling and work. What did you do to keep yourselves occupied and your leisure and so forth?
Well, mostly it was sport. You used to play a terrible lot of football. but in those days, we didn't have, like they have in these days, where people, you know, certain people or the council organised various activities in the sporting lane. We did have a school football team, but of course you only had, 11 players. You had a lot of supporters, right? But, I played for them once, but as I say, this particular teacher that wouldn't teach me how to spell, he was in charge of the football team, so I wasn't one of his blue-eyed boys. Used to do a lot of walking, and there wasn't very much more to do. Occasionally, if you had the money, you were allowed to go to, you could go to the cinema. Then you went to the local dances, but it's still there now. There's a great big miners' welfare in Pelton Fell, and it had there was a library in. We were going books. There was a great big dance hall where they had dancers in there. There was about five, well, with billiards in those days, not snooker, billiard tables. We used to go there, and that was about it. And having a lot of happy times with your fellow pupils.
What signs, coming up towards the end of the 1930s, were the signs that things were getting bad on the continent, that there may be war?
Well, I wouldn't know. I would not. I mean, papers in those days were probably non-existent. And I can't remember much about that. Just possibly because I wasn't interested.
Where were you and what were you doing when that announcement came that war started?
Well, I was living in One Milton Terrace, and I got myself dressed and I was going to go out for a walk. And it came over, that war was declared. And all the signs used to go. And my mother was saying, come in, don't go out, go out. I said, what the devil for? She says, well, the declared war, they'll be over any minute. I says, you can't even get lost. So I went and I had me walk. In fact, I was so conscientious in me working. I used to work not just a normal week like most people. I used to work more overtime than enough, just to so I would get more money to help my mother to be. And I was never. I always used to work on a weekend with the onset and people that repairs the lines and that in the mine. And he used to always meet me dad in the local club, and he used to say, tell the lad to come in tomorrow, kid. That was what he used to get. And it went on for years. In fact, I worked so much overtime, I lost so many friends. They just come to the house and I was never in. And I always remember this particular time, my dad said, you've got to go in tomorrow. I said, I'm getting a bit fed up with it. I don't think I will. He says, well, it's up to you. And I always remember it was snowing that time. And I went out and I walked about 10 miles in the snow. And I said, that's it. No, well, I will work a little bit overtime, but I'll not commit myself to living down the mine all my life.
This was overtime down the pit when you were with the pit.
I was pretty good on the uptake on most things. Like when I went in the army, if they showed me something, said this is how we stuck a brain gun down, that was it. I knew it straight away. But give me a book, I'd have a dickens of a job, sort of. Now I was like that in the mine. In fact, when I used to go down in the mine, the chief overman, who was in charge of the particular pit at that time, used to say, stand there. And I had to stand beside him. And as the miners was coming in and going to the various jobs and all that, he said, well, so-and-so's off. He says, go and do his job. So-and-so's off. And to finish, I was looking after 20 men on a cold face, and I was filling the tubs for them, putting their tokens on. I used to carry extra picks in, extra lamps in for them. I used to have to take an oil lamp, because we all had electric lamps in those days, but I had to take an oil lamp for gas, you know, to see if there was, make sure there was no gas. In fact, I had to look over them. And for that, I used to get 5 shilling a week off them, if I was there. You see, in those days, when you had 20 men working on a coal face like that, one man used to draw all the money for all the wages. You didn't get it separate. That particular coal face was all put down with so many pounds, and one man used to draw it. And he always used to meet outside Pelton Fell Workman's Club. There was a fish up there and had a big bench, and they all used to sit on there, and he was all the money was dished out. Now, if I was there, I got the half crown. But if I wasn't there, I didn't get it. And it didn't say, well, I'll be there for you next week.
What were the working conditions like down the pit?
Oh, very primitive. Very primitive. I mean, I used to travel about 3 miles of about 4 foot. You doubled up, you couldn't walk. And I had to work in that height. Well, a tube was about that high. It would say, that's the roof of the tunnel. A tube was like, and you only had that much room to work in.
That's
how we caused such a lot of accidents. That's how it happened. This. And I used to work with ponies as well, which was a sin against God, that allowing ponies to be in the mine. It was terribly tread. Not by me, mind, but I've seen some out there. I've had standing up rows with various pony drivers for treating them badly. In fact, what I used to do, my mum, I used to drink a terrible lot of water in the mine because it was so hot. And I had a great big water bottle like that. And she, in my coat, inside, she put great big pockets. And before I went down, I used to fill them with grass for to feed the pony. And I'm pleased that with the closing of the mines that the ponies is out of it.
Did you get involved in the union side of mining?
No, I was far too young then. Well, I'm saying far too young. I mean, when I was getting up in my 20s and all that, I still...
You left the mines and, as I say, ultimately you came to the ordnance factory. With the immediately before the war, was the ordnance factory making press to make more weapons
Yes, they're going full out. Just on the basic weapons that the army was fitted with, I mean, 25 pounders. That was one of the main products that we made, 25 pounder shell cases. And then they started to make shells after that. But it was only, you made the raw components there, and they were taken elsewhere to be fitted up and filled, like Aycliffe was the one, Chorley, and I've been to all these places at various times through first aid, and I did quite a lot of civil defence with the Royal Ordnance Factory. And then in the TA, when I joined the TA, every year you should have to go away for a fortnight's camp. And this particular time we went to Millham over inside Barron Furnace. They had an old aerodrome there, and they'd built a village, but it was like if it had been bombed, you know, for a teacher to do civil defence. It was safe enough, but it looked like it had just been bombed. And I did very well there. I got the second best marks out of the whole brigade. In fact, I got a letter there from my CO congratulating me. So I was very interested in civil defence, very interested in first aid. And I was very, very hurt when I was finished at ROF, because I was finished on a technicality. I was off work waiting for a report from a specialist. I said, that particular time I was suffering from nervous disability. And they asked for volunteers for redundancy because they were trying to cut the staff down. And they brought this redundancy scheme out, and I got a sheet like, and I came home and I worked it all out. I said, oh, I said, I'm volunteering for this, because I was worth about £43,000. And when I went back, they said, you can't join it. I says, what for? He says, you're over retired age. Now, a lot of people in this country think that retiring age is 65. Well, it isn't. It's 60. And through the grace of God or the grace of the government, they allow you to work another 5 years. But if you finish at 60, you wouldn't get a pension until you were 65. So I was 62 at the time. So I wasn't allowed to do it. And about 3 or 4 weeks after that, I was sent for and I said, we're going to finish you. I said, well, you know, why? And they showed me this rule in the book, where it's like King's Rules and Regulations. You know, in King's Rules and Regulations, on one page it says, you can do this and you can do that. And you turn the page over and it says, you can't do it. In fact, King's Rules and Regulations, you can't win. In all government rules and regulations, you can't win, because there is something in there which counteracts the other one. So they showed me this, and it read something like this. Owing to the fact that I'd been on the sick, that I couldn't do my job better than a young man. Now, the job I was doing was, as I'm telling you, head turning. I was working the thousands of an inch. In fact, it should have been a skilled job. And there was nobody who would have wanted it. There was only a lad called Jimmy Sterling, who I met on Saturday night at the dinner. There was only him and I would work those machines. And he wasn't very happy on it. And in fact, if I was off and to put someone on, so whenever I went back to work, that chap flew away, he went. So that was, I says, well, I'm very, you know, I'm very hurt about this. Now, only the service that I had, the director was bound, they're not to give me an interview. I had to write him a letter, like. I wrote him a letter. And the last words I wrote on us is, you have hurt me something terrible. You couldn't have hurt me if you had stuck a knife in me back. Because I did a lot of good work in that one. Right. Apart from first aid and civil defence, I knew making shell cases off to the tee. And I used to say to the management, look, you're doing this all wrong. I shouldn't have been doing it. I should have let them get on with it. But no, I saved them thousands of pounds. So I said, look, if you give me another thousands of an inch on the base of that case, I'll save you all this scrap. And I mean, they were getting thousands of cases of scrap. At this particular time, we were making engine starters, cases for the start of these jet engines up in those days. And that just a few things, you know. I mean, you get a new foreman doing something blooming stupid. I said, look, you haven't got to do it like that, man. In fact, the Royal Ordnance Factory was a haven for bad tradesmen. It was a haven for bad tradesmen. And this is a fact, this. They had some Burlick furnaces there, and they had sumps about three times as big as this room. And down there were electric motors and everything. And this particular millwright went in one week and he turned the tap on to do something. And he forgot to turn it off. And when I went in on a Monday, my locker was near this furnace, and I looked out, and it was about that far off the furnace door. And if that had gone in, it would have been a terrific explosion. Mm. You know what they did with him? He got promoted to foreman next week. And this is the system which is all wrong. I say, if you serve your time, you should sit a test to say that you're qualified to do it. Because there's a lot of chaps who serve the time and they're not qualified when after the period of time. And that's what happened in the Orange Army. Now, the AEU, which was a strong union in those days, that was all the tradesmen. You couldn't do nothing with them. Even the management in the Royal Orange Army couldn't do anything with them. And for any management to turn around and prove that a tradesman was inefficient was practically impossible, because he served his 6 or 5 years or whatever it was, and he was a tradesman. Didn't matter which is as thick as that wall, he was a tradesman. Eh? Now, the only way they could get rid of him was to promote them. Eh? He was on a job, he was making, say, thousands of scrap cases. He said, well, what the devil are we going to do with this guy? Well, make him foreman. So he said, well, they promoted him and got him off the job. That was all wrong. And I was very, very hurt. In fact, this is what I mean, if I say I'm going to do a thing, and 9 times out of 10 I do it, because it starts worrying me, it starts niggling out. When I had this interview with this director, I went to all my service with him. He says, you've got a marvelous service. Second to none. I says, well, what the devil are you finishing this for? He says, well, you've been on the sick. I says, look, sir, I says, you treat me worse than a bad timekeeper. And I mean, at that particular time in the audience, right, the bad timekeeper was serious. You get people going out round to the Legion for their lunch and never coming back. In fact, it became a joke, and the foreman said, will you work Mondays and Tuesdays, and don't forget Fridays as well, because Friday was, you know, a day off, sort of, as they were classed. Anyway, I says, you treat me worse than a bad timekeeper. You know what he turned around and said? He says, that's why you're getting finished, because we can finish you dead easy, or a lot easier than we can a bad timekeeper. And I know that for a fact, because at one time, the shop where I was in was the North Quay shop, was terrible. You were working for washers. You were risking your lives for to try and make money. And the management wouldn't help you. Nobody would help you. The Bloomin' Union wouldn't help you. And this particular shop steward started getting a bit too airy and on. I said, oh, well, you've been there too long, and I put up against him. And I finally became a shop steward for a year. And I think myself, I did do some good for the men on the floor. And I did some good for the management and all. Now, while I was a shop steward, every now and again, the labour officer used to send for it, or the personnel officer, a chap called Duckworth used to send for me, and he said, so-and-so is not coming to work. He's been off 4 days this week. He don't. I says, well, it's obvious he doesn't want the job. I says, why don't you finish him? He says, we can't. He says, to finish a bad timekeeper, we've got to get 5 people on a board, and not our own people, 5 from different ordnance parties, come and sit on a board. If they decide that the case against them is correct, and we have to finish him, we've even got to compensate him for losing his job. He says, so therefore, it's far easier for I found in the end, it's far easier to finish me on a technicality there than having to cost so much blooming money then. And then, what did I come out with? I come out with £4,500. And I should have had approximately 43. So they saved a lot of money there. And I was very hurt on that. Well, I took them to the Industrial Tribunal. And there's a lad, lives in Lumley here, a lad called George Fasey, him and I. Now, he had a better case than I had, because he wasn't on the sick, he was on compensation. He'd been injured. But he was still finished on this technicality that I just saw. When we walked in to this office, there was a barrister and two lawyers sitting. And the first thing this lawyer said to George, "You sit over there out of the way." And in fact, we thought we were blowing criminals. Now, the union let me down on that, because the union official that knew my case conveniently went on holiday at the time that I went to the industrial tribunal. So they say, but in fact, he didn't go on holiday. They sent a stranger with me. And the fact the stranger was asking me what he had to say, which was all wrong. And I walked out of there and I said to the clerk of the court, like, I said, "I'm very unsatisfied with this." I said, "In fact, I can't understand it." And I said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do." I said, "I'm going to go to London." And I said, "I'm going to get an interview with the Secretary of State." And I says, "Then I'm going up to Buckingham Palace and I'm going to see the Queen." And I walked out. And I think he must have followed me out. I lived in a place called Milton Terrace. Yet Home Avenue, Chester Street. That's where I was living at the time. And I hadn't been in the house half an hour when it was all these papers pushed through the door. How to complain about industrial tribunal. Now, the reason why I didn't go to London was I said I was suffering from nervous disability and I was making myself ill with worrying about it. So I just stopped it. And what I did, I sat down and going back to the meeting with his director, I said, I'll be honest with you. I would like to retire. But I says, I can't afford it. I says, 62. I says, I've got to wait another 3 years for a pension. I says, I haven't got the money I haven't got the savings to live at that time. So I says, I'll be honest with you, I would like to retire, but I just can't afford. So I had to sit down and do my sums. And Touchwood, I think I did all right. I sat down and I said, "Well, my friend, who's he's in the Masons, I met him in the TA, and I've been friends with him about 50 years. He said to me, he said, 'You're wearing a hearing aid, Dave.' I said, 'Aye.' He said, 'You can get a pension for that.' I said, 'Oh, can you?' I said, 'Where did you hear that?' 'You know, this is concern thing that they have on the telly.' I said, he said, 'I heard it on there.' I said, 'Oh, and what, how do you go about it?' And he told me, so I went and I got a hearing aid. I got a pension for my hearing, industrial injury. So I'd try to do everybody else a good favour. Everybody that worked in the ordinary factory in the noisy shops, I says, put in for hearing aids. Right? And I'll union secretary, he applied, but he worked at a quiet shop and he didn't get it. But he was talking to the union solicitor, and the union solicitor says, "You can sue these people for this." I said, "Oh," and I said, "Then how would you go about that?" Because I was so adamant against the Royal Ordnance Factory. He says, "You do this and do that." So I filled up the phone in. And eventually, after a year and a half, I was awarded £4,500. So I sat down and I thought a bit more, and I said, "Well, Maggie Thatcher's going to give me £7,500 for Council House." I said, if I do, buy the house, after, it was 5 years in those days, but now I think it's down to four, you can sell it." So I did that. And out of those little bits of savings and all bits of awards that I had and the sale of a house, I mean, I gave the house away. I mean, it's worth £45,000. I only got 20 for it. But when I had to pay the mortgage off, I think I got about £11,000. And that money I put in a bank, and I never touched it. And I eventually got it up to £25,000.
We've come actually to the end of the story, really. And I would normally do this at the end, but that's okay. We'll not bother with it then. Can we go back to when you joined the TA? When did that happen?
Well, after the war, I was a company sergeant major in the 1st Battalion in Italy. And after the war, they were doing all sorts of getting the joint to stop on. I mean, you would go out horseback riding and all. I mean, in fact, my day used to consist, I used to parade the company parade on a morning. I used to parade the people for office, you know, on charges and things. That took about a half, and that was it. And the rest of the day was free. And I would just, you know, enjoy myself.
So, sorry, you came into TA after the war. Is that right?
Yes.
You joined the TA?
I thought
it was before the war.
No, no.
Oh, can we go back then to the beginning of the war? You said where you were when the war started. Was there concern in the family that the war is on and you might well be pulled into it?
Well, I suppose the war never said anything to me, like, you know. I remember when the first conscript was called up, I was too young. When there was a batch that said, right, from 21 to, I don't know, 23, whatever it was. I was too young. See, I wasn't 20. I was only 20. And when the next batch came up, I was right in the middle of it. See? So I had to go and report. And I always remember, I've got it in there, I went for a medical. And after the medical, you went and saw Colonel Bowers. And he was asking, you know, where would you like to go and all this. And he said to me, well, what would you like to do? I says, well, the headlines in the north that particular time, the headline, we want 5 million dispatch riders. I says, I would like to be a dispatch rider. He says, can you ride a motorbike? I says, no. He says, well, that's not much. He says, if he's dispatch rider for you, no way out. So he said. Now, there's only two regiments I didn't want to go into. It was the Daylight and the Green Howards. Because I'd heard such bad things about them, you know, in the Great War. They said, oh, they're blowing sandbag, man, and they just throw you over the top and they get shot. But on the 5th of January 1940, I had a report to Brunswick Castle. I went to Brunswick Castle, were issued with everything, supposedly everything, and we were taken from there. And the bus had no wind, is he? And I says, what the devil's a no wind, is he? And they say, oh, if there's a bomb drop, she'd get cut with glass. That was the idea in those days. They took me to Willington, and I was put in the Love Memorial Hall in Willington. That's where I first started in the British Army.
So the process was that when your age came, you were called up. You had a letter,
right,
and you went for a medical, you said. And then, of course, you're supposed to indicate where you'd like to go, but you didn't get there. when you got to Bransforth, what was the reception like, walking through, you know, the castle entrance?
Well, it was amazing. Like, it was something new that was happening to me, you know, and I couldn't absorb everything that was happening. The only thing I can remember about Bransforth at that particular time, was standing blooming naked in a freezing corridor, because it was cold in January, getting your jabs and the blokes was fainting and all that. And then they only gave us denims, so they didn't get uniforms. We didn't get proper respirators. We had this little red box with a white tape on with a civilian respirator. Our rifles were straight out of the box, thick of grease, and they were like that for... Well, in those days, you used to do drill for 8 weeks, and then after that, you had 8 weeks weapon training, teaching about. So my rifle lay at the side of my bed for 8 weeks, and you imagine what it would be like in a back room.